I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Before we get to our guest, I'd like to thank some donors. Countercurrents is doing our annual fundraiser this year, and we are off to a good start. We are trying to raise $150,000, and thus far, we have raised $10,272.80. We have received 38 donations since our last podcast, and I want to read through the names of the donors and thank them, and then some of them sent in questions and comments, and I will go through those as well. So Matthias sent 50 euros. Thank you very much. Daniel sent in $2,000. Exceptionally generous. Thank you so much. Tito sent in $500. Michelle, $250. Band, $20. Dustin, $25. Big Hair sent in $50. Andrew sent in $250. Bridalbick sent in $5. John sent in £75. Hunt sent in $100. Peter, $30. Henry, $20. Ricky sent $300. Kiki sent $88. Dark Enlightenment sent $100. And then earlier this week, I did a live stream debate with Andrew Anglin, and we received a number of donations there, both through DLive in terms of their tokens and also through Entropy. We've already thanked everybody and answered the questions of the people who donated during that debate. We agreed that we were going to split the proceeds 50-50, and so I received $37 through Entropy, 5 euros through Entropy, and $128.28 worth of DLive's tokens. This comes to a total of $4,057.53, and our total so far is $10,272.80. I want to thank everyone for their generosity. Currently, the only way that Countercurrents can receive credit card donations is through a platform called Entropy. Entropy was set up to help people who are doing live streams receive donations. These are called paid chats or super chats. And if you would like to send a credit card donation, just scroll down this page and you'll see the Entropy information. Go to Entropy and you can send the donation that way. And if you want, you can enter a comment or a question, and I promise that I will read and comment on your comments or questions in each of our podcasts. Hunt writes, "To Greg and everyone at Countercurrents, best wishes." Thank you, Hunt. Peter writes, "Hang in there." Thank you, Peter. Bridalbick writes in, "How and when did you become racially conscious? Have you always preferred whites to the other races, or is this the result of certain experiences?" I grew up in a very homogeneous community. It was almost 100% white. There were a couple of people that I went to school with of mixed race who were partly American Indian or Asian, but the town was almost 100% white, and it was certainly 100% normatively white. So I didn't really think about race all that much in connection with how I led my life or politics. Again, I was a kid. But as a kid, I was very, very interested in history, physical anthropology, geography. And so I was fascinated with other races, other peoples, peoples in the Amazon, people in Indonesia, Africans, Asians, and so forth. I was constantly reading up on the different peoples of the world. But I think during that entire time, I probably had a natural and unconscious preference for my own type, but I was curious about other people. It was an intellectual curiosity, and that curiosity hasn't changed, really. As far as race becoming a political issue, well, I think largely because, again, I grew up in such a homogeneous environment, I simply took that for granted. And I started out as a libertarian individualist. I became more conservative over the years. And finally, when I realized that we really couldn't have the kind of society that I envisioned with ethnic and racial diversity, then I came around to thinking that we really do need to have ethnically homogeneous homelands. John writes in, "Best wishes to all at Countercurrents." Thank you, John. Ricky writes in, along with a donation of $300, which is very generous. "This is Ricky, a longtime reader and essay contributor to Countercurrents. My best wishes to you, and I wish that you will stay strong and continue to thrive in your cause for truth and justice as a great intellectual beacon." Well, thank you, You've been an enormously helpful writer and translator over the years, and this is a very, very generous pledge of support. So thank you very much. Keiki writes in, "This is Keiki. I wish you to continue to spread truth to the general public and grow robustly in days to come. Thank you very much." She sent a donation of $88. And finally, Dark Enlightenment sent $100, and his message is for the RSS. We are getting a new RSS feed set up so everybody can get their favorite Countercurrents content delivered to them fast and easy. So again, everybody, thank you so much. If you would like to donate to Countercurrents through Entropy or through any other means, please scroll down. We have a lot of information on how to help out. My guest today is Countercurrents writer Nick Giulvi. Nick, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here with you, Greg.
You are one of my favorite new writers at Countercurrents, and I find your work really interesting because you sort of evolved out of the broad neo-reactionary sphere into what we'll call the dissident right. I call ethno-nationalism, whatever. And I really wanted to explore your background and your milieu and your intellectual journey, because I'd like to see if there's any potentiality for creating a kind of NRX to dissident right pipeline. So do you want to address that? We've been talking about this a little bit beforehand, and I'd really like to share some of the insights that you have.
Well, thank you, Greg. Well, yes, I grew to become an ethno-nationalist, or as I prefer to call it, a dissident rightist, and specifically an ethno-nationalist, after spending some time calling myself a neo-reactionary or generally a reactionary. This was the period, you would say, immediately preceding the election of Donald Trump in the United States, and I would say the beginning of the year 2018, where I was still reluctant to call myself a nationalist, an ethnic nationalist, due to, well, my libertarian background. Before I was a reactionary, I considered myself a libertarian for a very long time, and eventually an anarcho-capitalist, because if one takes libertarianism and just takes its telos and its assumptions about the world and drives them to their logical conclusion, one arrives at basically anarcho-capitalism, and not any anarcho-capitalism, but Hans Hermann Hoppe's anarcho-capitalism, the one with protection agencies, with insurance companies functioning as protection agencies. And yes, that old 2016 meme, physical removal of those who advocate for, say, communism, socialism, any form of statism. Indeed, if the private property owners so choose, physical removal of persons of other races, chiefly to, well, for self-protection against the negative externalities of having such people present in a community, which I do not believe I have to re-enumerate for our audience. This is well known. And indeed, if one follows the intellectual journey of even Mencius Moldbug himself, who is the chief neo-reactionary, you could say, or at least in an intellectual sense, it's not like he commands the movement. And, he himself grew out of Hoppean libertarianism, although apparently he did it much earlier than me. And basically, he cut through the epicycles of Hoppean libertarianism. There's an interesting phenomenon of Hoppean anarcho-capitalism. How are we going to keep the state at bay? Well, the insurance companies will do that because state actors will decrease their profits. And there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the human animal, which we have become accustomed to seeing in all libertarians. But essentially, even in this model, there is nothing stopping the insurance company CEO or owner or board of directors from declaring themselves a state and acting in a state-like fashion. And indeed, from what we know about early human history, kings and state-type entities, kingdoms and other state-type entities arose out of mutual protection pacts because the world is a dangerous place, and a man in a band of warriors is far likelier to protect himself and his people and his property than, you know, man alone. And, you know, bands of warriors function best when you have a single commander and the entire unit moves as though animated by a single spirit. And, yeah, basically this is how you get a king. And from there, we more or less have a handle on how history has gone.
Right. Yeah. The basic principle of feudalism is that receiving protection engenders obligations to the people who protect you. Yeah, that is the basis of feudalism, and really the basis of any kind of state, ultimately.
The first entities of this type were really tribal entities where the king was no more than a commander. So, for example, one thing, I read the Odyssey when I was very young, I believe age 8, maybe 9, and one thing I was very amazed by the Odyssey and the Iliad is depictions of Ulysses plowing. And I say, isn't he the king? Why is he plowing? Well, in those times, the king was basically the military commander. He may have had, you know, everyone else has one field. He has two fields. Everyone has, you know, three oxen. He has four oxen. But these state-type entities, these early tribal state-type entities, were very egalitarian.
Anarchism is going to evolve into a kind of government. If you actually do the Hoppean experiment, history is going to start over, and your anarcho-capitalism is going to give rise to some kind of state.
Yes, I had, you know, a discussion with a perfect stranger on Twitter today to exactly that effect, that basically anarchy is diffuse tyranny, that anarchy allows strong, martially inclined people to abuse martially disinclined people. Let's not call them the weak, but yeah, basically the weak. Mm-hmm. And of necessity, people will band together to protect themselves against roving bands of bandits, and they will, of course, expect, you know, the people who are protected to pay back something in kind. Or it could be a situation where the people needing protection will call on the rough men to protect them, as in Seven Samurai.
Right.
You know, we are going to get dismissed as LARPers for quoting a Kurosawa movie. And the alternative to tyranny isn't anarchy, it's order. It's a state of being where, of course, the weak are protected, but the strong are allowed to be free. Freedom is something which in medieval times, in the feudal era, for example, was considered a privilege of those who could afford to be free. And it came with basically being on your own recognizance. The vast majority of people need protection and would, given the choice, choose to be subjugated to someone. Subjugated is such an ugly word, but subject to someone who can provide them with such protection, be it a king, a republic, insurance company. Someone will be out there holding the big stick and chasing the bad people away, and people will pay him tribute.
When did you move from being a Hoppean to being a reader of, say, Mencius Moldbug and participating in these NRX discussions?
I would say it was a process of maybe 2 years in which I gradually started doubting the precepts of... I was already red-pilled on the race question, and you could say I was never fully blue-pilled on it, because I live in the Balkans, and we see people who should, by liberal or libertarian or even Hoppean rules, cooperate for their common self-interest. I've seen them literally, in the case of the 2001 conflict, try to kill each other for points of pride, for ethnic differences. So for entirely non-material reasons, we have non-cooperation. So this tension between my belief as a Hoppean libertarian and my lived reality, observed reality as someone who can observe ethnic and racial and religious and every other kind of tension when the mechanistic processes of liberalism tell me that, well, no, these people should be cooperating because their economic self-interest is to cooperate. This led to a gradual unraveling of my view, and a friend of mine who was also going through this same process, who was himself a libertarian, a Hoppean anarcho-capitalist, he began reading the NRX blogs. I believe someone mentioned it on the Z blog in the comments, and then Z commented on Mencius Moldbug, and then my friend began reading it. And then I started reading Mencius Moldbug, and suddenly a lot of things clicked into place. Like, for example, why this thought, one thought, which is very interesting, very powerful for me. I thought it was Moldbug's for a very long time. Turns out it comes from Thomas Carlyle. If you abolish a term, you do not necessarily abolish the thing. So, for example, you can abolish the state church, but it doesn't mean that you have abolished the state religion or that there will be no state religion. It just means it's going to happen under the table where it can spiral out of control. And that is, I would say, the essence of neo-reactionary thought. If you can get a handle on, you can abolish a term, but not the thing, not the concept. If you can get a handle on that, you can think like a neo-reactionary. But it's difficult for people because they are mired in modernity. They lack the conceptual tools to think like that.
Is the argument that there are certain, I don't know, illiberal institutions that simply can't be done away with, and that liberalism just blinds us to certain forms of heteronomy that we all depend upon, and therefore reaction, therefore conservatism?
If, like I said, if you abolish the term, you do not necessarily abolish the institution, or if you try to abolish the institution, you do not abolish the concept. So, for example, in the West, we have done away with in most countries, with the official state church, and even such places such as the United Kingdom or Norway or Denmark, where they have a state church, this state church is toothless. For example, the Archbishop of Canterbury cannot decry drag queen story hour or transgender children, but the high priests of progressive liberalism can and do decry the Church of England and Anglican Christianity. So what has happened in denying the idea space to, you could say, an official church, we now have an unofficial state faith, which is run amok. And this is progressive liberalism, which Mencius Moldbug genealogically traces back to progressive Christianity in the late 19th century, the same religious fanatical force, which was the main philosophical impetus between the war between the states in the United States, on the northern side, of course. Abolitionists of the middle 19th century are the progressives of the late 19th and the early 20th century, are the radicals of the 60s, and are the SJWs of today. They are the official church, which we cannot decry as having gone mad with power because, well, they aren't the official state church. They are the state church, but you cannot point your finger at the archbishop and say you're going too far because he does not wear the vestments of an archbishop.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly.
Quite credibly claim that he's not an archbishop.
Yeah. The whole Enlightenment narrative is that we're giving up superstition and religion and embracing reason. And the reactionary responds, well, no, that's not really true. There's going to be a sort of conservation of irrationality in society. There's always going to be a huge amount of irrationality in society. And if religion is no longer the place where it's centered, it's just going to pop up in the guise of fanatical campaigns for social justice and things like that. But we never get really more rational. with progress. We never progressed to greater and greater rationality. We simply changed the forms of superstition. But in the case of losing the state religion, we also lose any kind of person who could be held accountable for this. And therefore, the problem of irrationality just becomes, it becomes almost unsolvable. How do you battle against basically a mindset that has no authorities, that has no official institutions? You know, you can't find the cardinals of political correctness meeting together in a room and spring in and arrest them all and clap them in jail or anything like that. It becomes a kind of tyranny that's diffused. It's the same way that in politics, you know, liberals think they can get rid of rule by men, rule by deciders, the sovereign function. They think that they can just talk and talk and talk, and that there will be never any necessity of having people empowered to decide. But what that does is it simply takes who makes the decisions out of the public spotlight, and the real sovereigns in liberal democracy are sometimes people whose names we don't even know, and therefore they can't be held accountable. They're pressure groups and oligarchs and people like that. They're the ones who step in and eventually stop all this deliberation and create some kind of consensus so things can move forward. So there's a sense in which modern liberalism and the Enlightenment, they don't really do away with the things they think are irrational. They actually make them more pervasive and more difficult to fight in some ways.
I will remind everyone of that G.K. Chesterton quote. What an eminently quotable man he was. He who believes in nothing will soon believe in anything. If you consider yourself a supremely rational man, if you consider, I don't believe in superstitions and yada, 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 you could think of it in this sense of, say, religion as a vaccine in which your desire to link yourself to the numinous and the, which is necessarily irrational beyond the pale of human perception and reason, and unless you have organized religion with living traditions to anchor yourself to, basically you will take on anything which even remotely resembles the numinous, and political fervor is one of these things. And as to you were saying that we can abolish rule by men, I understand you meant men as, you know, people, but the Church of Progressivism is so advanced that it really wants to abolish rule by men as a gender. And now what we're seeing in, for example, the United States is a lot of these female senators, these women are becoming senators, but one doubts how much real power they wield. And so many of them are married to men of the donor class. So it's not just ruled by men as ruled by people instead of the mythical rule of law, which, you know, never happens because, I mean, I'm a lawyer. I will tell you there is no such thing as rule of law. It never will be, because I can look at a constitution of a country and I can derive, or maybe not me, but a sufficiently talented lawyer can derive any justification for pretty much anything out of a written constitution. So it's always the guy doing the interpretation of the law and someone who decides which interpretation of the law is valid who rules. And that's always a man, and more often than not, a man not just in the sense of a human being, but a man as in a biological male. Because I don't want to sound sexist here, but women don't really have it in them to make those decisions.
So what was next? You're reading people like Moldbug, you're discovering Carlyle. What's next?
Mencius Moldbug is just the surface level, and a lot of people, he's very difficult to read unless, I guess, you have a certain disposition for obscure texts, and a lot of millennials might be turned off. He definitely has that Generation X cynicism, which I know annoys me. And but the deeper you get into it, the more you realize he's trying to solve an equation, he's trying to develop a political formula for rule in the modern world, but he is either deliberately or, you know, either deliberately or through no fault of his own, ignorant of some very easy heuristics, which you would know just from following, you know, the traditions of people. And we can chalk that up to Mencius Mollbug not coming from a people with a long tradition of developing functional political formulas. They're very good at developing non-functioning political formulas, but the functioning one. Or we can chalk it up to his reluctance to think of man as a biological entity, you could say. I've noticed not just in Mollbug, but in other neo-reactionaries, as far as they are concerned, human biodiversity, well, it ends with IQ. And, well, of course, obviously IQ is interesting as it differs among races. I'm far more interested in, the various neurotypes which form the moving parts of the human society. That's really interesting to me. The amazing neurodiversity of people indicates to me that we are a species of immense and incalculable levels and nuances of specialization. And so developing a single formula for all people would seem to be unwise at the very best. And of course, these are differences between individuals, between groups within an ethnicity, and between ethnicities and races. And Mollbug just spends, you would say, hours and hours running around in circles, which he could just not do if he had just read not J. Philippe Rushton, but read about the work of J. Philippe Rushton, that genetic similarity theory actually bridges a lot of gaps in Mencius Mollbug's thoughts, but he seems either willingly or unwillingly unaware of J. Philippe Rushton's work on there. I guess it's because it smells a little bit too much of Kevin MacDonald.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Rushton is famous for Race, Evolution, and Behavior, which is a very interesting book, although it's an oversimplified book. He only really talks about three races, for one thing. The work that he did that I thought was most powerful and most useful for ethno-nationalists is his work on genetic similarity theory. Maybe Race, Evolution, and Behavior might frighten somebody like Mollbug, but the work on genetic similarity theory is, it's not really adjacent to American Renaissance or Kevin MacDonald or and those kinds of discourses, but it is a very important foundation for ethno-nationalism. I make reference to that in my manifesto, for instance. I think that's an absolutely foundational basis for understanding why diversity just doesn't work.
Well, there's your answer right there, because if one takes genetic similarity theory, it just becomes naturally apparent that if we want a peaceful, stable, and orderly society, no matter what the political or economic system, it will function better if it's ethnically homogeneous rather than ethnically diverse. Now, the problem we have to understand, I always have to keep reminding myself when I read and when I reread Mollbug, this is a guy who is very allergic to being put in the same box as anyone mentioning ethno-nationalism, anything that even remotely smells of maybe Jared Taylor, Pat Buchanan, and Kevin MacDonald. And I have noticed this in some of the neo-reactionaries who are active right now, while they will denounce the cathedral as an evil entity which must be defeated, they will still keep its values and as regards status hierarchies, and they will, this is maybe the problem of basing your movement in any intellectual sense on a cult of power of sorts. You start venerating power whenever you find it. And these people, they notice the various college professors and transgenders wielding immense amounts of power, and they see that the people speaking truth to power are quote unquote very low status in what they say. And this is only to be expected. Anyone who endorses an ideology explicitly opposed to the ruling class is bound to be some form of malcontent. I don't want to use the term loser, but in the sorting algorithm of a competition between people, it's the people who ended up with less than someone else. And so they will, this is only natural. And I'm not saying that people become right wing or become distant rightists because they're a loser. This all happens at a subconscious level. But I think it's this attempt to disassociate oneself from people who are, I will say again, quote unquote, low status, and not realizing that the cathedral, that Globo Homo's idea of what is high status and what is low status is so inverted and twisted that basically an able-bodied young man of 20 or a well-spoken man of 40, you know, people who would be high or at least higher status in any normal society, speaking out against power, they consider this, oh, you're low status, you're doing this, you're doing that. I think it's just this, and there's a good deal of the people imagining themselves to be of low status and low value because they are against the ruling order. You can say it, that the ruling order is evil, it should be done away with, you can understand it rationally, but at your core, at the level of the lizard brain, you're still so frightened of it that you implicitly and subconsciously repeat many of its memes and things that keep it in power.
You know, years ago, when I was living in New York, I met some guy, and I honestly don't remember his name. I might not have gotten his name. He was in this NRX world, and he was introduced to me by a friend who sort of overlapped in those spheres, and we were having lunch, and he was talking about his NRX stuff, and I talked about ethno-nationalism. And his response was, well, you know, different ethnic groups can have their own little provinces. And he actually used the term from the Ottoman Empire. Is it vilayet?
That betrays a lack of understanding of history, because in the Ottoman Empire, the division of vilayets was administrative, and it referred to a vilayet as basically a county.
Yeah.
But the division between ethnic and religious groups in the Ottoman Empire was by millets. And millets are distributed geographically. So, you know, for example, I live in a country which used to be part of the Ottoman Empire. If I am a Christian and my neighbor is a Muslim and our neighbor, the third neighbor, is a Jew, then you have basically three millets represented in our street, because you had the Sultan, who is also the Caliph of Islam. He was the head of the Muslim millet. And then you had the Patriarch of Constantinople, who was the head of the Christian millet, of Millet al-Rum, which meant the Byzantine or Roman millet. And then you had the Chacham, or the chief rabbi of Constantinople, who was the head of the Jewish millet. And later on in the 19th century, when the Sultan recognized that the age of nations had come, and he started splitting off the various non-Muslim populations into nation-based millets. So you had the Serbian millet, the Bulgarian millet, the Greek millet, or rather the Rum millet was transformed into the Greek millet. But these were not geographically divided entities. The vilayets were counties administered. So in a sense, the millet system is far more similar to the census system of the United States.
Right.
You are part of the Hispanic, whatever it is, no matter where you are in America.
Right. I think his point was simply that we at the center, we the elites, we at the top of the social pyramid, we'll create little Indian reservations and allow these people to have their folk dances. You know, they'll dress in their colorful costumes and dance around in circles and clap your hands. The underlying assumption was that we are talking to the upper 1% of the upper 1%, the elites. And diversity is a problem that will be simply solved by some sort of Indian reservation system. And it won't interrupt the grand game of politics, whatever that is. And of course, the underlying assumption there is that diversity can be contained within a society, and that the real issue is what kind of elites that we have. I was kind of frankly appalled with this guy, and I didn't want to really get into it with him because I figured I'll never see this guy again. But I sort of made a note about that, and I just thought, you know, there's a pattern here. This sort of tips the hand a bit of the NRX people. This guy's giving me a sense of their water cooler conversations, right? The kind of stuff they talk about around NRX headquarters. And the concerns that I have are on a much lower level. They want a multicultural, multiracial, hierarchical system where they're in charge and they can deal with these ethnic issues at that point. And to talk about the Ottoman Empire as a model was frankly revolting to me. I really wanted to just say it didn't really work out well for the Armenians, did it?
If we are talking about the Ottoman Empire, it didn't really work out all that well for the Turks either.
Right. It was a machine. The Ottoman Empire is not unlike the Byzantine Empire or the Roman Empire or the American Empire. It was created by a core ethnic group, but they created a machine that made them ethnically replaceable. And slowly over time, the people who ran the Ottoman Empire had a very, very distant connection to the Turks who founded it. And it's the same with the Byzantine Empire. I mean, it was the Roman Empire. They thought of themselves as the Roman Empire. But all those Roman bloodlines died out. It was a machine that consumed the people who created it. It liquidated the founding stock and just kept bringing in new populations and feeding them into the machine. And that's not a very good model, frankly, for anybody who values their ethnic identity, values their genetic and ethnic continuity. If you're building a society, it's perfectly reasonable to say, I don't want the model where my bloodline and my culture are just slowly shuffled out and replaced over time. That's a crazy model. You would want to build a model where you have a posterity, where you can pass on something of yourself into the future and perpetuate it over time. And these empires were really bad at doing that.
I have seen what you might call Altaic Turks, people from the Altai Mountains. They live in villages where I live in Macedonia, near in the northeast of the country. These people look more like what I would imagine Attila the Hun looked like than the people you see in Istanbul. I have distant relatives. I believe that a cousin of my great-grandfather converted to Islam in the early 20th century, and his descendants, whom I've met in Istanbul, they call themselves Turks, but they look like Balkan Slavs, which is to say there's an even proportion of you know, dark-haired and blonde-haired white people. And they ostensibly practice Islam, but there are rumors that these people, these conversos, secretly practice Christianity or whatever religion they had before. So, like I said, the Turkish vilayet, there was no Turkish vilayet. There was no Turkish millet. There was a Muslim millet, and the Sultan was its head, and everyone who was a Muslim, regardless of ethnic or racial origin, just gets lumped into this group, and okay, we are Turks. And it destroyed the nation, the original nation. And what's more, their conquest had undone them, because once they opened the machine to everyone who would convert to Islam, these Altaic Central Asian people were very rapidly outcompeted by Slavic and Greek conversos to Islam, who were just more intelligent, had a lower time preference, and to this day form the Turkish elite. But I want to address the notion that, oh, we can have the various ethnic reservations for the little people, for the popolini, whereas we, the beautiful elite, it is implied we will be a tribe of values, which is, the biggest problem you have to a stable society is elite cohesion. If you look at the history of peasants uprising, not one of them has realistically succeeded. They're very romantic and they appeal to our sense of rooting for the little guy. I mean, I enjoy watching Spartacus as much as the next guy, but realistically speaking, the real danger to state or regime stability always comes from elite infighting and elite sabotaging each other, and ultimately elites declaring war on each other, civil war. And what better way, as we know from J. Philippe Rushton, to have cohesion within a group, say the elite, than genetic similarity between them, even if they are vastly outnumbered by the people, and even if they are, you know, somewhat hostile to the people. If an elite is genetically homogenous, it will run roughshod. We know from the history of England, where we have a more or less homogeneous Norman elite ruling over Anglo-Saxon and Celtic peoples, this is what made England great, the homogeneity of its elite, you could say. And of course, there's also that caveat: if the elite is of a different genetic stock than the people, the elite will be likelier to exploit them willy-nilly. Mm-hmm. Which is a problem. I have written a lot on the dangers of just ruthlessly exploiting the little people, because these are the people who, even if you are part of the elite, these are the people who will serve in your armies. You are up the creek without them, really.
Yeah, yeah. With these NRX types, and I'm really generalizing from this one person, and then little bits and snatches of other conversations I've had, and reading things online, but the attitude I thought was sort of equal parts, well, they really are a pretty genetically homogeneous bunch, at least some of them are. Or this guy was basically falling into what I call the spelling team fallacy, the spelling bee fallacy. It's the idea that, you know, you go off to college, right? And college is a place, it's a meritocracy, and it's a meritocracy where you have people from all different races and religions and things like that. They're all brought together because they're really, really smart. And if you want to have the best darn spelling bee team in the world, you don't recruit people who are all your race or your religion. You recruit the best spellers, right? And they could be of any group, right? And that kind of college model, I think, infects a lot of high IQ nerds, right, that get involved in radical politics. And there are even people on the alt-right, or people who sort of moved through the alt-right and are sort of off to the one side now, people like the alternative hypothesis guy, who never really gave up on that kind of the college meritocracy model, the multicultural college meritocracy model. And, well, college isn't real life, for one thing. And when you look at colleges and how they operate, well, there are a whole lot of ethnic mafias running around in colleges, too, that we have to be aware of that might give them a certain amount of cohesion, but also put a lot of greasy thumbs on the scale, so it's really not so meritocratic when you get right down to it.
I think it should be obvious to people. This is why, even though it could be true in a certain sense, I don't like this IQ fetish that our side tends to have. Is okay, I get it. We can solve problems. High IQ, whoop-de-doo. The problem is, you don't win by solving problems. Life is not a video game. Life is not an activity in which success loads on IQ as much. I mean, IQ is important, but because it's a team effort, it's far more important to be able to coordinate with people on your team to understand the distinction between my team and not my team and the various nuances which come from that.
Yeah, it makes a difference when you have that kind of organic connection, and we really have lost that. And people have made a lot of money from dismantling America as a white society. There's no question about it. But they built a weak structure that is now being stress tested, and we are finding out just how expensive all those cheap goods are from China, just how expensive it is to get all this cheap labor in from Mexico. One of the things that's happening is we're now getting stories of everybody in a particular meat processing plant is sick with coronavirus. Now, chances are, given what I know about those industries, the people who are working there are illegal aliens who are living 8 or 10 in an apartment. They are people who don't have any social distance in their normal lives and who don't pay much attention to what's going on around them because they have language barriers and things like that. We're finding out how expensive all this cheap labor is, and it's only going to get more and more expensive. So let's move to another topic, and that is, how do you think I at Countercurrents could maybe open up conversations with the NRX people? I've tried to do this in the past, and it just hasn't really gone anywhere. Do you think that there is a possible NRX to dissident right pipeline that could be put in place based on your experience? I mean, you're one guy that I know of who's made this journey. Do you think other people can make this journey? And is there anything that I could do to help that out? For instance, I would love to debate some of these people. I'd love to debate them about ethno-nationalism, white identity politics, and all that. But I'm not hearing it. One thing that is kind of encouraging, though, is that Mencius Moldbug, Curtis Yarvin, is now popping up in more mainstream sites, as has Bronze Age Pervert, which I think is an interesting thing. There's some movement going on there. Some barriers seem to be breaking down there with basically NRX and what you can call West Coast Straussians, I guess. And I'm just wondering, are there things that I can do to make other barriers a little more porous, to get more interesting intellectual conversations going?
Well, it's interesting you use the term Straussian. Wasn't Leo Strauss the one who said that it's, you know, the common folk should be religious, but the elite should be secular?
Or that they should have a completely different religion, yeah. One of the things about Strauss that I think is very, very interesting is he gave a picture of ancient Greek society, because he's talking about Plato and Socrates, right? And his model of the Socratic philosopher really sounds more like the court Jew of the Middle Ages than the actual Greek philosopher in relation to public life. It is interesting that the Claremont schools, which are sort of the center of West Coast Straussianism, seems to be a place now where Curtis Yarvin and also this character known as Bronze Age Pervert are being reviewed or actually being published. So I think that's interesting because Bronze Age perverts, that's a whole different chapter, a whole different podcast. But he does seem to be, how to put it, NRX adjacent.
I would say Bronze Age pervert is equidistant between us and NRX. I really try not to think of him as a serious philosopher, but as a Nietzschean aesthetic hammer wielder, really. And when Nietzsche says how to philosophize with a hammer, he's not referring to smashing things, but of testing whether a piano is tuned. It's a piano hammer.
Right.
So that's what Bronze Age pervert is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But with regard to Straussianism and religion, I would say that historically, at least, we notice that the elite are the ones who are fanatically religious, whereas the common folk have a sort of a nonchalance with regard to religion. To them, it is really the passage of the seasons and the tides of the sea and this sort of animistic, sort of shamanistic in the pagan era overlaid with Thor and Zeus in the Christian era with Jesus in Muslim areas with Allah. But it's the common folk basically worship the various states of nature, whereas serious religious fanaticism, and I do mean fanaticism as in I am so religious that I will walk from London to Jerusalem in order to slaughter infidels type of fanaticism, that occurs in kings, in barons, in counts, in knights. And the idea that and this really makes a lot of sense. The elite are the people who, in the Hegelian duel of dialectic, will not yield, right? You know, two men fight, and the man can either die or keep his honor or yield and become the slave of the other. Well, the elite are usually the people who will not yield. They have very high thumos. Whom will they yield to? Only the alpha who is so supreme, he has absolute, he's omnipotent, so only to God. This mm-hmm. is why you need to, if the elite does not submit to God, they won't submit to anyone. And then you get elite civil war. You get, you know, they stop cooperating. They start sabotaging each other and the state becomes unstable. So I always conceptualize of myself as an anti-Straussian. Like, the common folk can believe whatever the hell they want. It's very important that we get the elite believing in God and submitting themselves to God's will. Who that God is, well, I don't want to say blasphemous things on Easter, but it's important for the elite to believe, to be religious.
You know, that's a very interesting take. Yeah, the idea that you can have a ruling caste of society, which consists of people in our society, it mostly consists of people who have excelled in academia and business. But there's still a bit of thumos there, and there's certainly a lot of big egos. And the idea that you can have a functioning society where you have elites consisting of people with gigantic egos that are struggling for domination with one another and cannot conceive of any power in the universe higher than themselves is obviously going to be a group of people who are, well, they're constantly at war with one another. It's a prescription for civil war or chaos or just constant dysfunction amongst the rulers unless they can submit to a common will that's bigger than any of them, that has a bigger ego than Donald Trump even, right? And that would be God.
Yeah, I always think about this because I think of who is the kind of person who will enter the dissident right, and it's a high thumos man, and it's also the kind of man that Bronze Age pervert is trying to attract. Someone who is so high thumos that he will not submit to what is the most powerful empire in the history of humanity. Now, this is all well and good. We are very awesome and very attractive, Nietzsche and Übermensch. But the problem then arises of how are we going to cooperate together to attain political success, or really any kind of success, if, you know, why do we have this constant problem of the dissident right always infighting, always everyone running their little fiefdom and not being able to accomplish anything. And if you think we're bad, you should look at Neo Reaction. Every Neo Reactionary has his own blog, which is to me, okay, you guys are taking it a little bit too far. There's so much wasteful duplication here, just from a business perspective. And the answer to me is, remember why you're fighting. Remember that you're fighting for something which is much bigger than yourself, which is, you know, we're doing this for our people. Our people, my people, are, you know, we are a small nation, but still vastly bigger than any one man. And I think that the problem of the West and the problem of basically deformalizing the church, you know, removing the official churches of the West, what happened was when the freedom of religion was instituted and there was no longer a state church, then people were free to start believing that they are indeed not just holier than thou, but holier than God, that they're more alpha than God. You know, why shouldn't I break this religious taboo? Why shouldn't I behave in this prohibited manner? We have freedom of religion, right? And this eventually spiraled into what we have today, where you're basically signaling your virtue, signaling your holiness by taking your children, sacrificing your children's, well, not your children physically, but sacrificing their genitals to Baal or Moloch.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is the same thing from a Darwinian point of view, basically. If your child is burnt alive in the brazen bull, or if he's castrated and can no longer reproduce himself, from a Darwinian point of view, that's the same thing. This can happen to any religion. It can become self-destructively fanatical, and a check on it is having an official structure and keepers of tradition, and it really is only a check for, I would say, so long before the ego of participants, that this desire to be the holiest, the most virtuous, the most, you know, this is fundamentally aristocratic drive to be the very best, as it says in the Pokemon song. It's only a matter of time, and maybe the best we can get with a good socio-political formula is 100 years of stability, at which point, you know, the cycle is repeated. Another blind spot of men, not just Mencius Mulbug, but many reactionaries, is they do not appreciate the cyclical character of history. They say, oh, we can fix things with only minor corrections to the way our society is. And oh, like the first proposal Mulbug ever made, let's just formalize power. Let's just give power to he who holds it, to the media, to the universities and the critarchy, the court system, the civil service. Let's just recognize their power and it will go right. I don't want to use the term black pill, but I'm not as optimistic as to the present system. I think that the spiritual and genetic quality of Western civilization is just, it could be too spent to have any sort of serious revival. I hope I'm wrong, but the problems we are facing will not go away with minor corrections. We're going to need maybe a major overhaul of the way things are done in the West, or I don't want to get into this. It's a whole another, not just a podcast. It's a PhD thesis level of discussion.